This is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Anna Mateo.
Companies in Japan are increasing their use of technology to reduce food waste and cut costs during the coronavirus health crisis. They are using artificial intelligence, or AI, to help those efforts. The businesses are also looking to increase their sustainability efforts. Government information from Japan shows that it throws away more than 6 million tons of food waste each year. The cost to handle this food waste is estimated at $19 billion. This means Japan wastes more food for each of its citizens than any other Asian country. For this reason, the Japanese government has enacted a new law. Its goal is to cut the costs of food waste by 50% from levels in 2000. The government wants to reach this goal by 2030, and it is urging companies to find ways to solve the problem. Convenience store operator Lawson is now using AI from the U.S. company Data Robot. Data Robot uses technology to find ways to make supply meet demand. In places where this program has started, Lawson aims to reduce having too much of a product by 30%. The company has similar plans to the Japanese government. It wants to cut its food waste by 50% from 2018 levels by the year 2030. The second biggest cost for Lawson's store owners is disposal of food waste. Its highest cost is labor. Drink maker Suntory Beverage and Food is experimenting with an AI product from another Japanese company, Fujitsu. Suntory wants to know if products such as bottles of tea and water have been damaged in shipping. Until now, that has been done by human labor and takes a long time. With new AI technology, Suntory hopes to learn more about how its products get damaged while being sent to stores and how many will need to be returned for replacement. Suntory aims to reduce the return of goods by 30 to 50% and cut the cost of food waste. The goal of these efforts is to develop a system that can be shared with other food makers and the companies that transport their products. Japan's shoppers are known for being very fussy, but even they are showing signs of agreeing. This is especially true as the coronavirus health crisis hurts people's incomes. In 2014, Tatsuya Sekido launched Kurarashi, an internet-based business that sells surplus food at a discount. He started the company while working for a Japanese company that did business in China. There, he saw huge amounts of waste from food producers. With about 800 companies, the online network is doing very well. The reason is partly because of an increase in demand for low-priced foods. Shoppers are increasingly concerned about prices during the COVID-19 crisis. Sekido told Reuters sales grew 2.5 times last year from a year before, while the amount of food waste has doubled since the coronavirus cut off the food supply chain. The companies get shoppers by offering low prices and a chance to donate to worthwhile causes and social issues. That is not bad for business either. Membership numbers jumped to 180,000 in 2021, from 80,000 in 2019. Other businesses have joined forces with food companies in developing new technologies to cut food waste. NEC Corporation is using AI that estimates demand based on several conditions, such as the weather, the time of year, and people's buying behavior. NEC has used AI with some major retailers and food makers. It has helped them reduce costs by 15 to 75%. But a top official at NEC told Reuters that reducing food waste is not the company's final goal. Yoichi Morita said he hopes reducing waste will help solve other business problems. These, Morita said, include reducing costs, increasing supply and demand efficiency, and fixing labor shortages. I'm Ana Mateo.
In an episode of the humorous television show Family Guy, an unusual short discussion takes place.
Hey, you're not in uniform. Are you guys cops?
Are you guys cops?
They know we're not cops!
Today's report is not about police, criminals, or funny shows. Instead, it is about pronouns. In this everyday grammar, we will explore second-person plural pronouns in American English and other kinds of English. Personal pronouns are among the first pronouns you learn in English. Think of words such as I, you, we, and they. In English grammar, we often describe pronouns in terms of person and number. The person can be first, second, or third. The number can be singular or plural. Take the pronoun I. It is the first person singular pronoun. The first person plural pronoun is we. The third person pronoun also has its singular and plural forms. But the second-person pronouns are a little unusual. You is both the singular and plural form. You might wonder how English speakers deal with speaking to others. How do they show if they are already speaking to one person or more than one person, especially in everyday discussions? English speakers around the world have different ways that they deal with this problem, as we will see. Speakers of American English have many ways to show the difference between second-person singular and second-person plural. Sometimes they use both of you when speaking to two people. Sometimes they use all of you or some of you when speaking to groups. Imagine a lawyer needs two people to sign a document. The lawyer might say,
I need both of you to sign this document.
If the same lawyer were speaking to a group of people, he or she might say,
I need all of you to sign this document.
Or,
some of you need to sign this document.
In everyday speech, Americans have several other ways they show the difference between the second person singular and the second person plural. Think back to the words you heard at the beginning of this report.
Hey, you're not in uniform. Are you guys cops?
Are you guys cops?
They know we're not cops!
Note that both speakers used the term you guys to show that they were speaking to several people. Imagine this situation. School children are getting out of control. One student might tell two or more other students,
You guys need to calm down.
In some parts of the United States, speakers use the term y'all as the second person plural. A video called The Many Meanings of Y'all explores the many uses of the term. The video notes that a speaker might greet two or more people by saying the following.
Hey, y'all!
But please note that the video also makes fun of the difference between y'all and you guys, which we will explore in detail in a future report.
Hey, you guys! What are you all looking at?
Another second-person plural pronoun, yous, is also used in America, but such usage is growing increasingly rare. A 2017 opinion story in the Chicago Tribune suggests. The opinion story described the decline of yous in America and noted that you guys and y'all have risen to take the place of yous. When you listen to English speakers from around the world, you will hear slightly different second-person plural pronoun usage. In a paper on New Zealand English, Laurie Bauer notes that some speakers use a second-person plural form, yous, as well as other forms, such as yous guys and you guys. Bauer suggests that yous likely comes from Ireland, although it is also found in parts of Scotland and the north of England. He adds that you guys likely comes from America. For now, you should be very careful about using any pronouns other than you. On writing tests, for example, you would probably not want to use y'all or you guys. The next time you are watching films or listening to everyday discussions in English, pay careful attention to how speakers use the second-person plural pronouns. Over time, you will build a strong understanding of when and how to use different pronouns. I'm John Russell.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The Second World War ended with the surrender of Japan in August 1945. Americans looked to their new president, Harry Truman, to lead them into a new time of peace. Truman was vice president until President Franklin Roosevelt died suddenly in the closing months of the war. Almost no one expected President Truman to be as strong a leader as Roosevelt had been. And at first, they were right. Truman had one problem after another during his first months in the White House. Truman's first big problem was the economy. Almost 2 million Americans lost their jobs as factories ended wartime production. Americans everywhere worried about what would happen next. Only a few years before, the nation had suffered through the worst economic crisis in its history. No one wanted to return to the closed banks, hungry children, and other sad memories of the Great Depression. In some ways, the economy did better after the war than many experts had predicted. Many Americans still had money they had saved during the war, and Congress passed a law designed to help people keep their jobs. The situation could have been much worse than it was. However, the economy could also have been better, much better. Almost overnight, the price of almost everything began to rise. President Truman tried to stop the increases through a special price control agency that had been created during the war. However, thousands of business people refused to follow the government price control rules. Instead, they set their own prices for goods. Store owners would tell government officials that they were obeying the price controls, but often they charged whatever they wanted for the goods they sold. Businesses were not the only ones who were refusing to obey government price controls. Organized labor did the same thing. President Truman had always been a friend of labor unions, but during the first months of his administration, he became involved in a fierce struggle with coal miners and railroad workers. The first sign of trouble came in September 1945. A group of auto workers closed down factories at the Ford Motor Company. Then, workers at General Motors went on strike. Soon, there were strikes everywhere. The oil industry, the clothing industry, the electrical industry, and more. The strikes made Truman angry. He believed the striking workers were threatening the economy and security of the United States. He became even angrier when union representatives came to the White House and refused to accept the compromise wage offer. Truman ordered the army to take over the railroads and the coal mines. Within a short time, the striking coal miners returned to work. However, the president had less success with the railroad workers. He became so angry with the unions representing them that he asked Congress to give him the power to draft all striking railroad workers into the armed forces. The rail strike finally ended, but millions of Americans lost faith in Truman's ability to lead the country and to bring people together. By late 1946, most Americans believed that the man in the White House did not know what he was doing. Truman seemed weak and unable to control events. Union members disliked him because of his strong opposition to the coal and rail strikes. Farmers opposed Truman because of the administration's effort to keep meat prices low. Conservatives did not trust the reforms that Truman promised in his speeches, and liberal Democrats watched with concern as many of Franklin Roosevelt's old advisors left the government because they could not work with Truman. In November of 1946, the people voted in congressional and state elections. The results showed they were not satisfied with Truman and his Democratic Party. Republicans won control of both houses of Congress for the first time in 18 years, and Republicans were elected governor in 25 states. The election was a serious defeat for the Democrats, but a disaster for Truman. Some members of his party even called on him to resign. Few people gave Truman much chance of winning the next presidential election in 1948. However, Harry Truman began to change in the months that followed the 1946 congressional elections. He became a stronger speaker. He showed more understanding of the powers of the presidency. And in matters of foreign policy, he began to act more presidential. This was especially so in Truman's reaction to Soviet aggression in Germany. Truman wanted to rebuild Germany as well as the other war-torn countries of Western Europe. As we heard last week, his administration worked closely with Western European leaders to rescue their broken economies through the Marshall Plan. But the Soviets did not want to see Germany rebuild, at least not so quickly. At first, they flooded Germany with extra German currency in an effort to destroy its value. They walked out of economic conferences. And finally, in early 1948, they blocked all the roads to West Berlin. West Berlin was in communist East Germany, but not under communist control, as was East Berlin. After the war, the Allies had divided Germany in half. West Germany had a democratic government. East Germany was communist, under Soviet control. The Soviet actions in Berlin were a direct threat to the West. Truman had three difficult choices. If he did nothing, the world would think the United States was weak and unable to stop Soviet aggression. If he fought the blockade with force, he might start a third world war. But there was another choice. The Allies proposed the idea of flying tons of food, fuel, and other supplies into West Berlin. Not just once, but every day, as long as the Russians continued their blockade. It would be a difficult job. West Berlin was home to 2.5 million people. No one had ever tried to supply so large a city by air. Planes would have to take off every 3.5 minutes, day and night, to supply the people with enough food, medicine, clothing, and badly needed coal. The operation involved American C-47 and larger C-54 transport planes, along with British Lancaster, York, and Hastings aircraft. On June 26th, the first C-47s landed at Tempelhof Airport, the beginning of the great operation that was to come. Plans called for the operation to last just a few weeks. The planes landed in the blockaded city, and local volunteers provided support on the ground. Former mechanics of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, joined Americans in servicing the aircraft. More than 20,000 Berliners worked day and night to build an additional landing field for the American and British planes. It became Tegel, now Berlin's major airport. As part of the supply effort, the British Royal Air Force even landed Sunderland flying boats on a Berlin lake. Brigadier General Joseph Smith was appointed task force commander of the American part of the airlift. General Smith called the mission Operation Vittles, using an American slang term for food. Operation Vittles also led to Operation Little Vittles, or the dropping of chocolates and other treats to children. The pilots who did this became known as candy bombers. Appreciative German children called them the Schokoladenflieger, the chocolate pilots.
They wanted to know which airplane I was in. I said, you tell my airplane on regular wings, and then you'd know that's me. Watch just that airplane. And they says, good, that's Lindenborg. I came back the next day, and I put little parachutes for the Galgumi and the Chocoladen so they could see it. And so it would hit them hard in the head, slow it down. And so I wiggled the wings, and boy, they waved their hands, and I pushed it out of the airplane. And that's how it started.
It was the idea of Gail Halverson, a pilot in the United States Air Force. Lieutenant Halverson became known as Mr. Wiggly Wings. From his plane, he would drop chewing gum and chocolates attached to tiny parachutes made from handkerchiefs. Soon, many of the airlift pilots were dropping candy from their planes, including into Soviet-controlled areas that they flew over. Americans back home supplied the handkerchiefs, and the chocolate industry supplied the treats. Years later, in Berlin, Gail Halverson told German interviewer Rolf Gründer how he got the idea.
I dropped chocolate because of gratitude. I met 30 children at the fence at Tempelhof, and not one put out their hands and says, give me more than flour, give me more than coal, give me chocolate. And they had no chocolate. They had no gum, but they would not be a beggar. They're so grateful for flour. And I said, wow. They were thankful. And when people are thankful, good things happen.
It soon became clear to the Soviets that the Berlin airlift would succeed. In May of 1949, almost 1 year after they had started their blockade, they ended it. The crisis in Berlin changed the way many Americans saw their president. Harry Truman no longer seemed so weak or unsure of himself. Instead, he was acting as a leader who could take an active part in world affairs. Truman's popularity increased. However, most Americans did not expect him to win the election in 1948. Almost everyone believed that the Republican candidate, New York Governor Thomas Dewey, would capture the office. The election campaign that year turned out to be one of the most exciting and surprising in the history of the nation.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.